of the Srimad Bhagavatam. We've been doing Unit 5, and which is chapters 14 through to 19. And today we should get through, we'll have a little summary considering the various breaks, so we'll just revise, get a bit of an overview of what we've done to lead us in to our discussion for this week. So we left off with Unit 4 in Chapter 13, and the very end of that chapter, of course, Narada Muni pointed out to the Pandavas that they should wait here on earth as long as Lord Sri Krishna was still present on earth, and so he was giving them an indication that Lord Krishna, you know, would soon wind up his pastimes, and of course that the Pandavas should follow suit. So then that leads us into chapter 14, and we see that Arjun had been sent to Dwarka. He'd been there for about 7 months, and the Pandavas wanted him to get some indication of Krishna's next movement, anticipating that in fact he could be leaving his, you know, this earthly realm, going back to the spiritual world. Arjuna returned from Dwarka, and Arjuna looked to be very, very dejected, practically unable to speak, and you know, considering his stature as a Kshatriya who had you know, his life experience, being banished to the forest, losing his kingdom, fighting so many demons, seeing so much death and destruction in the Battle of Kurukshetra, you could imagine it would take a lot to bring Arjuna to tears, you know, to that state. So, you know, to see Arjuna in that state, Arjuna was obviously trying his absolute best to control the outpour of emotions from the grief and separation that he would be feeling from the separation of Lord Sri Krishna, but try as he may, it was just not possible. And of course Yudhisthira could perceive this and was asking Arjuna, you know, what was the cause of his grief? You know, had something happened, which was, you know, what tragic circumstances had happened that brought him to this state? Of course, none of them really wanted to say what was actually on their mind, that, you know, has Krishna, you know, performed his disappearance pastimes. And of course, Yudhisthira inquired about the Yadu dynasty and, you know, the nature of Arjuna's dejection. So ultimately, at the end of that chapter, the 14th chapter, Yudhisthira concludes that has your dear friend, Lord Sri Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in fact departed. So therefore, in chapter 15, Arjuna did describe that yes, Krishna is lost to him, and you know, he fondly remembered Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead who protected them, all the Pandavas, and empowered Arjuna and the others, you know, in incredible ways. So he remembered that, and he also remembered other. So of course, you know, many incidents there where Lord Krishna protected them, saved them, and empowered them, in order that the Lord's mission to relieve the earth of the burden of demoniac influences be fulfilled. And at the same time, Arjuna also remembered how Krishna, although he's the Supreme Personality of Godhead, had a very intimate relationship with Arjuna and the Pandavas, which was, you know, based on friendship and not just the Lord's particular mission. Arjuna also, you know, described that now that the Lord has departed, of course, all those powers which were invested in Arjuna by the Lord had also been lost. Furthermore, Arjuna had the difficult task to describe that the entire Yadu dynasty had been destroyed as well. So he was feeling a lot of grief and separation, and at that time he remembered the instructions given by Krishna. In the Bhagavad Gita, is that nearly out? Can we put that out? Yeah, it's just my throat gets dry with the smoke. So, therefore, Yudhisthira, understanding that Lord Krishna had departed and the Kali personified had begun to enter, you know, he saw some of the symptoms of Kali, that he decided to retire. Queen Kunti also followed Yudhisthira's lead to retire, in other words to leave this earth to go back to the spiritual world, and furthermore Yudhisthira enthroned Parikshit Maharaj, you know, as the emperor of the entire world, and then the other Pandavas, they also followed in Yudhisthira's footsteps, and they attained the abode of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Sri Krishna, in their very self-same bodies. So then Parikshit Maharaj began to rule as a devotee of the Lord and under the instructions of the Brahmanas. He began to notice that the symptoms of the age of Kali began to infiltrate his state. What were some of the symptoms? What were some of the prime symptoms? Yeah. Well, I mean, illicit sex, gambling, intoxication, meat eating, these things began, he noticed that their influence was starting to infiltrate right into his very state, yes. So this is the beginning of the 16th chapter, and therefore he took up his weapons and also surrounded himself with an army, and he prepared to actually fight this influence of Kali Yuga. He then conquered all parts of the earth. So he went the entire earthly region to conquer the world and make sure that everyone was following the principles set down by Lord Sri Krishna and the Pandavas. Of course, on his visits, he always heard the glorification of the Pandavas and Lord Sri Krishna. And so he very much enjoyed that everywhere he went there was always this nice, you know, Lila Kirtan discussion, glorification about you know, his very his predecessors who were great devotees of the Lord and the Lord himself. Now at that time, while he was travelling, Dharma the bull, who was you know, religion personified and moral principles personified, was inquiring from Dharani, the cow, the earth personified, as to the nature of her distress. and we see that throughout the rest of the chapter that Dharani replies, and of course the greatest, apart from the fact that the Kali personified is introducing conditions which left her in a very thin state. Thin means that she was no longer getting the offerings from that were meant for the demigods. Calfless, of course, you know that the grains, which is considered the child of the earth, were not being properly produced because there's no jagdish and what have you. And, you know, the principal religions were not being properly followed. And she was very tearful. And, of course, she was also very tearful that Lord Sri Krishna, that she was actually feeling separation from Krishna's presence. So that brought us up to the chapter 17. And we see that in the first few verses, the Parikshit Maharaj comes across the bull and the cow. The bull was standing on one leg, three legs, having been severely beaten by a sudra dressed as a king who was none other than Kali personified. That sudra was also beating the cow. So, now, remember that these verses, excuse me, there's Russia. Can you just answer that? Unless there's a message, just ask them to call me back. We come across this same scenario at the very beginning of chapter 16, and then the sages ask, "What did you do?" And then so it takes up the discussion again at the beginning of the 17th chapter. Right, Maharaj. So you see in verse 16:4, you see how Maharaj Parikshit comes across the cow, the bull being beaten, and then it goes back to their conversation. Meanwhile, Parikshit Maharaj has been, you know, somewhere travelling around the world, and then it comes back. Yes, what did he do? Now it answers that question: what he did. So what did he do? He threatened to kill and punish that sudra, and he also questioned the bull and the cow as to who is the perpetrator, and that he would certainly kill that person. And we see that the bull responded without actually identifying the perpetrator. We can understand that Parikshit Maharaj therefore understood that that bull was Dharma personified, because his discussion, instead of just pointing the finger, he did it, you know, this one is the cause of my trouble, this one's the cause, like that. He understood that actually we suffer the results of our own activities, and by trying to unrightfully punish others, we actually suffer a reaction again, a new set of reactions. But because of the influence of Kali personified and the material energy in general, he was unsure as to whether to say that you know, everything is happening as a direct result of the, you know, will of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So he didn't quite make such a you know, direct statement as to who is the perpetrator. So then Maharaj Parikshit prepared to kill Kali personified, who quickly abandoned the dress of a king and surrendered, in which case Parikshit Maharaj spared his life but banished him from his kingdom. Kali described that, "So I've surrendered unto you, where can I live?" And he gave him five places that he could reside. Which were those five places? Okay. All right. Now, that's where we're going to take up, right, this week. So that's the summary of Unit 5 and how it connects with Unit 4. Any quick questions on that? Yep. Yes. Okay. Discuss the devotee's attitude towards suffering with reference to the response of Dharma, and how can you personally apply these principles? Out of 10, there's 5 for discussing a devotee's attitude. 2 for giving a reference to the response of Dharma. And 3 for mentioning how to personally apply those principles. All right, so we're taking up in chapter 17, and one of our Purva Svadhyaya questions, number 6, was to list the 4 principles of religion, and it was referring to verse 24 in the 17th chapter. Now, who can be our scribe? Maybe I can. Yeah? There's some pens there. So they're actually they're whiteboard. Yeah. Okay, and we had 4 principles. Who wants to? 4 principles of religion, as mentioned, actually in the translation. What are they? Austerity. Put them that way. If you Sanskrit would be nice. Very good. Tapasucham dayasacham. Now the next question. All right, so that was austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. They're the 4 principles of religion. The next question was, identify activities that destroy the principles of religion. And let's see. It asked us to look at verses 24 to 25 and text number 28. 38. All right. So we did that last time we met, but there was a little bit of uncertainty as to what we were supposed to derive from text 38. So we'll look at this a little bit more clearly. Okay. What we see in text 24 in the translation is that the bull's legs were broken due to rampant irreligion in the form of pride, lust for women, and intoxication. So 3 of the legs were, and then in verse 25 we see that in the translation it says, you are now standing on one leg only, which is truthfulness. But quarrel personified flourishing by deceit is also trying to destroy that leg. Okay, so underneath truthfulness, we can put that which is destroying it. So we put deceit. Then in the purport, Srila Prabhupada gives a summary that by pride, either artificial or real, the result and action of austerity is spoiled. And then he says, by too much affection for female association, cleanliness is spoiled. Yep. And then by too much addiction to intoxication, mercy is spoiled. When we say, female, ultimately we're talking about Purush and Prakriti. Purush is the enjoyer, Prakriti is the enjoyed. So, for women, sometimes they also take the mood of being the Purush, the enjoyer, and therefore the female, or the Prakriti, or the enjoyed, for them is the man. So, it's... Right? So, generally we have this term, but just so we don't explain it every time, female association, the man is enjoying the association of women for sense gratification, and for women, men is the female in that sense, the enjoyed. Right?
Where does animal killing come in?
Good question. So then, by too much lying, propaganda, truthfulness is spoiled. Okay. So where do you think that meat eating fits in?
Probably, yeah.
So you're saying, let's just, with another colour, until we confirm it.
Because you asked a question,
yeah.
I'm not giving any, I don't know the correct reference, but from what I've heard so far, I feel that the mercy, in terms of slaughterhouses has to go on to the mercy, and the addiction comes to the austerity. See, if you don't have, if you keep on having intoxication, then that may lead to, that will affect your austerity.
So you're saying swap them around. You're saying mercy, you're saying slaughterhouse, eat meat eating. So put meat eating in. Now you're saying that pride goes where? Okay, put that.
Pride also?
Pride. So pride destroys mercy. You can put.
No, because of the sense of pride, we eat meat, because we are enjoying for ourselves, and we are not the enjoyer, so we have an elevated idea. So, instead of.
So pride leads to meat eating, which destroys mercy. Or pride leads to meat eating, which destroys what?
Austerity.
Yeah. So you want to put, you want to put meat eating here.
Correct.
Yeah, yes. With pride. Okay, take that out.
Meat eating also.
Yeah. Mhm. So in the other colours here, you see some conclusions which we'll look at. And in the black we've got what the reference from the Srimad Bhagavatam. So just to be clear, we've seen from Srila Prabhupada's statements in verses 24 and 25 that he says that pride destroys austerity, too much female association destroys cleanliness, addiction to intoxication destroys mercy, and deceit and lying propaganda destroys truthfulness. All right? So just on some of these points, in the commentary by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur on verse 38, he says that with violence comes all the adhammas, or all the irreligious qualities. So he says that those who commit violence have no austerity, cleanliness, mercy, or truthfulness. So therefore, what's that?
Violence, what kind of, is it a riot or?
Well, he's just saying violence in general destroys all the legs of religion, and it creates all the irreligious qualities, which is no austerity, no cleanliness, no mercy, no truthfulness. That is just a little side note. Put that in red. Just, it is the commentary of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, and we'll look at that. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur's statement is that violence can literally destroy each one of those four. And we'll look at that. Now, then we go to verse 38. So that comment by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur was a comment on text number 38 of the 17th chapter. And Prabhupada says in his purport, one, he says that truthfulness, with regard to, let's say, he says that gambling of all description, even speculative business enterprise, is considered to be degrading. And when gambling is encouraged in the state, there is complete disappearance of truthfulness. So there, in verse 38, we put gambling. So now we see our, as we know it,
gambling,
illicit sex, intoxication, and meat eating. Right? So, for instance, so far under truthfulness, we've listed deceit and lying propaganda. Right? The regulative principle as we know it, which is the essence of all that, is gambling. Lies and propaganda is a form of speculative philosophies that are allowed to flourish. That's a form of gambling. Speculating on what is the absolute truth. It's a mental gambling. Gambling itself leads to all sorts of deceit. To be a gambler, you have to deceive yourself and everybody else. And everyone's constantly asking, where's the money going? Where did you get the money? What did you do with the money? Your whole life is just a lie. Gambling, and he's also including in gambling speculative enterprises, which means that we're performing activities which are a speculation. Instead of performing activities which are based upon the Bhagavad Gita, we're speculating as to what we should do. The whole modern economic situation is based upon, let us not follow what we know is correct, but let's just take a guess as to what we believe is right. It's another form of gambling or speculation. In some purports, Prabhupada describes, too much playing of sport. This also comes under the heading of gambling. And we see, of course, it's interesting, of course, that you know, in this age, sport is basically directly connected with gambling, as, you know, they bet on everything. Every sport there is just a money-making venture through the gambling, you know, houses. So, you know, we take gambling, we should understand that gambling includes all of these things and many more. You know, gambling is not just gambling with money, it's also gambling on sport, gambling as to how we should live our lives, speculating on what is the absolute truth or what to be done. So all, speculating on the, you know, on the stock market, all that sort of thing comes under, all sorts of speculation come under the heading of gambling. So it's not just throwing the dice and making a bet. Right? That's how Prabhupada sums it up. Yep. Okay. Then, in verse 38, we also know one of the regular principles: intoxication of all description, even smoking cigarettes, chewing tobacco, or the drinking of tea, must be prohibited. And of course, he doesn't say there in the purport what it destroys, but by process of elimination of what he does mention, what he doesn't mention, let's put it under mercy. We've already got it under mercy from text number 24 and 5. So we'll keep it there. He doesn't mention in the purport that it destroys mercy, but we've seen that truthfulness, he does mention, is destroyed by gambling. As far as cleanliness, he says allowing young boys and girls to remain unmarried more than 24 years of age and 16 years of age respectively. Again, he doesn't mention necessarily that it destroys cleanliness, but we're still taking that from verse 24 and 25. as far as austerity, we see that he says that licensing animal slaughterhouses of all descriptions should be at once prohibited. The flesh eaters may be allowed to take flesh as mentioned in the scriptures and not otherwise. Again, he doesn't mention that it destroys their austerity, although it's here, he's. If we look at our list of austerity,
21 for ladies, 24 for men.
Here we look at our list of austerity, and we've got pride, which was listed in the translation, and Prabhupada is listing, you know, the four principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness. here he's directly saying that you know, animal slaughterhouses should be completely prohibited.
Under austerity?
Yeah, under. So we put that under austerity. Now, Well, he says he says even cigarettes, tobacco, or drinking of tea. What to speak of coffee? That should be the influence. So if he's restricting these, then what to speak of that? That should be understood. Now, of course, in the word for word, it's interesting. Now, in the translation, of course, we see that Maharaj Parikit, this is verse 38, thus being petitioned by the personality of Kali, gave him permission to reside in places where gambling, drinking, prostitution, and animal slaughter were performed. All right, that's in the, therefore, He's chosen those four things because they are linked with the four pillars of religion, which are destroyed by those four activities. So we need to link them up, which we've done here. Even though it may not necessarily be stated in that purport where it's exactly linking. So, you know, taking a look at this, we see, let's take a look at austerity first. That there is an activity, one of the four activities destroys austerity. Maharaj Pariksit in text 38. links them with places where either, you know, slaughterhouses, illicit sex, gambling, you know, intoxication. So one of those four would link with austerity, and we see that in the very beginning also, verses 24 and 25, that pride is one of the things that destroys one of these three, so we know it's not truthfulness. Truthfulness is that the one that's very easily linked up with gambling. Here we see pride, and of course, as Chris was mentioning, that you've associated pride with a connection with, you know, violence, which then has a connection with meat eating, and of course, therefore, has a connection with slaughterhouses, which people should not have anything to do with in the age of Kali. As far as cleanliness, that was definitely much more readily connected with, you know, illicit sex. That was directly stated. As far as mercy, that was also yeah, we've connected that with So, is anyone a little doubtful as to how those connections are made? And what we've done, we've taken all the statements we can find, and does anyone feel that something is in its wrong column? No. So, it's very easy to see that gambling destroys truthfulness. Gambling is mentioned in verse 38, whereas in verses 24 and 25 it's mentioned more in the form of deceit, lies and propaganda. And we can understand that deceit, lies and propaganda, etc., and all sorts of speculative habits which are not based on authority fall under the category of gambling. And definitely, Prabhupada says in his purport, he links illicit sex with cleanliness. In the purport to verse 25, and also in the purport to text 25, he links intoxication with loss of mercy. Alright? And that means, and he definitely links pride with, you know, loss of austerity. Right, so that means that we must put meat eating and slaughterhouses as under as an indication, as a extension of the is pride, false or real. So pride, false or real, actually leads to violence against other living entities, and the last stage of that degradation is animal slaughterhouses. And the result of animal slaughterhouses is further violence as a reaction. And then we've got them all there because Vishwanath Chakravarti, the core in his commentary, 2 verse 38 says that violence actually leads to the loss of all of those, truthfulness, mercy, cleanliness and austerity. And it leads to, it actually leads to the all four irreligious qualities. So,
what level of violence?
Well, violence in itself at any level is, you know, there's definitely pride there. What's that?
Violence against women. In the cleanliness,
Generally, as you know, the propensity of violence, violently encroaching upon other people's rights, is to gain, you know, female association and to, you know, and to enjoy in their company intoxication and gambling, you know. Otherwise, why would, you know, if you're not attached to any of those things, there's no reason to commit a violence, you know. It's that desire to, you know, fulfill one's lusty desires in this world, which, you know, violence is there, you know, to facilitate that. Therefore, if a person is violent, it's understood that they're very attached to sense gratification in this world, which means they're attached to illicit sex, and in the company of, you know, the opposite sex, they want to enjoy intoxication to agitate their senses, and, you know, eat lots of meat to also agitate their senses, and enjoy the tongue, which, you know, has a straight line down to the belly onto the genitals, and you know, basically living a life of self-deception and deceiving others as to, you know, what you actually, you know, your intention is. So therefore, if someone is a ruler, just like we have in Italy, the prime minister who's, you know, being charged with sleeping with a 17-year-old girl, you know, she's, I think she's a... And, you know, for a man, he's in his 70s because she's about 17, you know, she's quite attractive, you know, on that level. So, of course, you know, for him, oh, I was just, you know, doing a good deed, and, you know, helping her out of it, and, you know, giving a little bit of charity and what have you. It's just, you know, a life of lies and deception and, you know, what have you, in order to live that life if you're a public figure. Even if you're not a public figure, you know, you're approaching someone's wife, you're approaching someone's daughter, you know, and your intention is to, you know, have illicit sex with that person, you have to lie, you have to, you know, deceive everybody, including yourself. So, you know, they're very much connected. But he considers that a person that comes to that point of violence, basically you can attach all the irreligions to that person. And because of that, you will not find any of the qualities of religious religiousness. So it is sort of, and I guess to the level of, you know, to the degree, the level of violence, to that degree, the complete loss of, you know, religious qualities and the complete being overcome by deeper and deeper and more powerful irreligious qualities. So they call that a pH test. What's that? It's an indicator. It's an indicator, good indicator. And of course, we see that Prabhupada in mentioning three prime symptoms of Kali, what does he mention? Three prime symptoms of Kali. It is one of the... What? I think so. Yes. He says, okay, sutras dressed like administers will kill innocent animals.
Religious principles are diminishing.
The principles of religion will be attacked by the sutra population. And of course, therefore, religious persons, what to speak of innocent animals and what have you, will all be terrified. But, you know, he lists these as, these prime symptoms of the age of Kali, principal symptoms of the age of Kali, that innocent animals will be attacked, like that. So, you know, that violence is a principal symptom of the age of Kali. Innocent animals attacked, and of course also the principles of religion. Therefore, persons religiously endowed will be terrified because they're attacking the principles of religion, which means that they will, you know, attack any persons who try to defend those principles of religion. you know, we see, if you ask, especially some of the, you know, older devotees, even in Melbourne, which is, you know, not such a difficult place in the world, but you know, the level of violence and aggression against the Hare Krishnas, you know, when we first become devotees, was you know, quite strong. You know, people were very, very angry. You know, they if they had any opportunity, they would like to, you know, violently attack a devotee. So, you know, it's a credit to all the devotees, some still here and some fallen by the way, of course, who have defended the principles of religion, you know, so that now, you know, devotees can literally, you know, go out and hold their head up high and as a religious person, you know, people respect them. You know, which is interesting because, you know, one of the things there we see that one of the questions asked is that Maharaj Parikit, he did not counteract the curse given by the Brahmana's son, what is his name? Sringi? Sringi. He accepted that curse. It was mentioned in the purport, he, you know, of course he was a great devotee of the Lord. He accepted everything as the will of the Lord, and he also didn't want to disturb the natural timing that obstruct the influence of the age of Kali, which was actually due to appear. Right? So on one hand, he doesn't want to obstruct the age of Kali. On the other hand, he is prepared to protect everyone and anyone who does not want to come under the influence of Kali. So therefore, he's willing to you know, remove Kali completely from his kingdom. So, you know, in that sense, Maharaj Parikshit is performing his duty, allowing anyone who wants to follow religious principles to follow them without being harassed by Kali. And at the same time, as a devotee of the Lord, he also allowed Kali to coexist, you know, during his reign without being envious. There's another question related to that, that you know, Maharaj Parikshit was not envious of the age of Kali, because he understood that the age of Kali also has some good qualities. In verse 7 of the 18th chapter lists some of the great advantages of the age of Kali. We'll come to that. But the point being that, you know, Maharaj Parikshit he reacted as a humble devotee of the Lord. He acted always being completely confident of the Lord's divine will, trying to follow the Lord's will and not try to interfere with it just for his own sake. And he also understood that any people who wanted to be protected from the influence of Kali, that it was his duty to give them that protection, and therefore he drove Kali, you know, to five different places which protected his citizens. And he also allowed that whatever good qualities are there in the age of Kali to flourish, such as, you know, just by chanting the holy name of the Lord, one can become free from all sinful reaction. Okay. So, of course, that leads us to discuss Prabhupada's mood and mission. Prabhupada's mood and mission, and we see that this comes up in the open book question. That's in two different parts. We were going to look at how the age of Kali was able to enter. Firstly, we looked at chapter 15, verses 32 to 37. Then we'll also look at chapter 18, 32 to 37, as to how the age of Kali was able to enter. And then the last part was to summarise Prabhupada's guidelines to defeat Kali and bring about peace and harmony in human society. We're going to look at that now, and that's specifically from chapter 17. So, just as a a prelude to this conversation, how to defeat Kali, from chapter 17. How was Kali able to enter, with reference to those verses in the 15th chapter, verses 32 to 37? Why couldn't he enter before? How could he enter then? What's that? Because Krishna left. That's right. Yeah. we understand that Kali entered at the end of the Battle of Kurukshetra, partially. So he was able to enter partially. Practically, you know, as such a, crucial stage when the, you know, ruling structure of the entire world was changing hands and had literally been destroyed. Kali took that opportunity to enter, but because Krishna was still there, he couldn't fully, you know, the next reign sort of hadn't really been set up properly. And Kali took that opportunity just before the strength of Parikit Maharaj and, you know, Yudhisthira sort of grew. But, you know, at least while Krishna was still present, he couldn't exert his full influence. So when Krishna left, then he exerted his full influence. Yep.
Krishna came to leave the earth of the burden and to give this message.
Yes.
So Krishna released the burden. And one would think that things become okay. But then as soon as Krishna leaves again, things become worse. So then...
Yes. This is Parikit Maharaj was saying, you know, or what we understand from the 18th chapter. But in the 18th chapter, it says text number 7, Maharaj Parikit was a realist, like the bees who only accept the essence of a flower. He knew perfectly well in this age of Kali, auspicious things produce good effects immediately, whereas inauspicious things must be actually performed to render effects. So he was never envious of the personality of Kali. So then, you know, in the previous verse we see it says that very day and moment the personality of Godhead Lord Sri Krishna left this earth. The personality of Kali, who promotes all kinds of irreligious activities, came into this world. In the purport there, it describes that if the state arranges to distribute transcendental sound by resounding the holy name, fame and activities of the Lord as they are authorized in the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, then a favorable condition will be created. The principles of religion in the world will be re-established. And thus the executive heads who are so anxious to drive away corruption from the world will be successful. Nothing is bad if properly used for the service of the Lord. We see there's also quotes in the 12th chapter, the 12th canto, that in the age of Kali, you know, the methods of God realization, self realization, which are very difficult, you know, to perform, can be very easily executed in this age of Kali just by chanting Hare Krishna and reciting Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. And that although the age of Kali is an ocean of faults, that we have the opportunity to take up that very easy process of chanting Hare Krishna. those who Those, now, generally the influence of the age of Kali would be that these, you know, principles of religion are destroyed. Austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness, with only, you know, just a fraction of truthfulness remaining. And that the irreligious qualities, you know, lies, deceit, gambling, addiction to intoxication, illicit sex, meat eating, pride, they will flourish. That's the normal condition of the age of Kali. And, you know, this violence against, you know, even innocent animals and all living entities practically is rampant. So, in essence, Krishna removed millions and millions and millions of powerful armies. You know, he literally destroyed them, their descendants. If we were living in Kali Yuga now, with all the descendants of Jarasandha, and I'm not sure that Kamsa had any sons, you know, if most of these demons, you know, with their millions and millions of soldiers, were still there, I mean, they'd be, you know, you can imagine, you know, how difficult it would be. As I said, you know, here, you know, in the early days of Melbourne, you get a few street thugs, you know, wanting to bash you because you're Hare Krishna. You know, but imagine just, you know, if we take some of the worst sort of militant, violent places on this earth now, if Krishna had not removed that burden of, you know, strength, the whole planet Earth would be that sort of condition. It's a big burden, definitely removed. There's still, you know, there's a little bit, and of course it increases later, but for us, in, you know, and for many thousands of years to come, we don't necessarily have that burden to deal with. Some problem. And on top of that, you know, Krishna left the Srimad Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, and previously in Krishna's age, you know, you had to take birth as a Brahmana in order to have access to the Vedas, and even those very, very qualified persons who were born in Brahmana families, gradually, and then being trained and studying all the Vedas, they may have access, and even then they have very little understanding of Krishna. You know, the understanding of Krishna is very, very rare. Now, in fact, the only real scriptures which still maintaining the parampara disciplic succession is the Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita, you know, literatures coming in our Vaishnava line. So ultimately, you know, when people want real religious principles, they may go to some cheating process and then find out that, oh, these scriptures are all being interpreted and this, that and the other. Ultimately, they come back and they'll see, oh, here's Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita. So, in a, you know, you, and then through Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam, you very quickly come to the understanding that always thinking about Krishna through chanting Hare Krishna, reciting, you know, his pastimes and what have you, is the only means feasible. So, in essence, when you look at what was set up now at the end of what, you know, basically Krishna has set it up in such a way that anyone who has the slightest indication to take shelter from the influence of the age of Kali will immediately come to Krishna consciousness. Whereas in the Vedic system, that wasn't even there. You know, they may take shelter of so many demigods, or you know, various Brahmins who were searching out, the goals of jnana or yoga, or like this, that, and the other. So, the way things have panned out as a result of all Krishna's activities has left us in a pretty good state, I would have to say. Right? But we can't begrudge Kali being here. So anyone who wants to go back to Godhead in one lifetime, that opportunity is there. But side by side, it's time for the most sinful of living entities to be severely punished. And therefore, side by side, in the age of Kali, those very, very sinful people will be punished. So we don't begrudge Krishna in punishing very sinful people through Kali personified. In the same way that in a state has a prison, people go to prison, they're very, very severely punished, we don't begrudge the state. It has to happen. And although people are being punished in the prison, in the free world, people live in with the facility that the government has produced. So we live like that. We live in the age of Kali, side by side with people are being severely punished, but we live with the legacy that Krishna has left us by removing the burden of the earth, giving us the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, the process to chant Hare Krishna. I don't. So it's not too bad. It is part of this discussion here as to what measures Prabhupada's guidelines to defeat Kali. Yes. Yeah. As long as a devotee wants to take shelter of Krishna, they will be protected from the influence of Kali Yuga. And the worst part of Kali Yuga is, for the majority of people, the devotees become fewer and fewer. One has to understand, of course, that Krishna said to Uddhava, at the end of the Srimad Bhagavatam, we see that Krishna advised Uddhava not to remain in this world. The influence of Kali is encroaching. We can see that Krishna has given massive amounts of opportunity to become Krishna conscious. That, what is it, 4 billion, 6 billion people on the earth at the moment? 6 billion? Amongst that, how many Hare Krishnas or people taking shelter of Hare Krishnas? They're protected from the age of Kali. The rest of them will take birth again in the age of Kali. A little bit further down the line, the next life, the same opportunity would be there. They might look at it and say, oh no, not for me, so but there might be a little bit of piety, but they may take birth again in the age of Kali. So if they dawdle around in the age of Kali for a long, long time, yes, the impetus will become stronger and stronger. Well, how about now? You want to go back to Godhead now? Maybe now. Okay, we'll see in your next lifetime. So then it becomes, more. So, it's a good thing it helps to push. And if people are just so sinful that I don't want anything to do with God or devotees, well then stay for the whole duration, stay for the whole party. So the moral of the story is, don't dawdle around the age of Kali, get out as quick as you can. If people do dawdle, then there's a little more impetus for them as Kali increases. You know, perhaps you should seriously look about going back to Godhead. Yes. Yeah, people become slower and slower, so we have to make it easier and easier. And, they need more and more facility. A person is very serious about going back to Godhead, they need no facility. You see when people joined in Srila Prabhupada, went to America, there's no facility. I'm serious to go back to Godhead, alright. There's no temple, there's no deities, the books aren't quite written yet. You've got the guru, that's enough. So they go back. Now we see, as Kali progresses, that the more facilities still, people, we need more facility to go back to God. So yes, Varnashram is more facility. We establish Varnashram, there's more facility for people. Okay, we're looking at verses 3 to 16, 24 to 31, and 38 to 45 in chapter 17, specifically with regards to Prabhupada's principles to defeat the age of Kali. So we see in the purport to verse 33, there's some wonderful statements. In essence, Prabhupada says, try to see that the cows and the bulls are happy in all respects. That's text 3. Yeah.
Ah, 16.
But you have to understand, on your question also, Nanda, that for people who dawdle and there's some little indication, little inclination towards, piety, but they're really, really attached, they may end up in the Kali Yuga, down the future, and they may miss a few valuable opportunities and literally go a real long way around, eventually coming back to the association of devotees. So they may have to suffer, even as devotees, in order to help them. But even, for them, Krishna will send bona fide gurus who are fully surrendered to the Lord. But those bona fide gurus who are fully surrendered to the Lord, of course, they'll always be, protected from the influence of Kali. There can be people who have some tiny tinge of inclination towards piety and may need that experience of great suffering in Kali to become serious. But even in the future, there will also be a different quality of devotees who are actually fully surrendered to the Lord. And you wouldn't expect that they would be suffering like the others, who need that push. They'll be, and this is what we're discussing here, how to remain transcendental or free from the influence of Kali, how to defeat Kali even while we're living here. Try to see that the cows and bulls are happy in all respects. Prabhupada gives some further discussion on that in that purport. Because he says these greatly sinful acts are responsible for the troubles in present. he sums up that, you know, take it from the authority of Srimad Bhagavatam and adopt the principles for total happiness. So there's the first clue where he mentions Srimad Bhagavatam, that we should take the Srimad Bhagavatam as the authority in Kali Yuga for our, you know, happiness. For all humans. In verse 4 of the 17th chapter, we see there's a discussion on the, it will only be possible to counteract the degraded age of Kali when we have administrative head like Maharaj Parikit. There's someone who can actually challenge the age of Kali. As it says here, majestic authority with weapons. Not an elected showbottle executive head. Right, so this is another way. We say we were discussing before about the Prime Minister of Italy. You know, he's completely under the influence of the age of Kali. How can he protect anyone else? You know, verse 5 in the purport carries along the same theme, that, you know, verse 4 is saying what we must have, a strong ruler like Maharaj Parikit who can actually challenge the agents of Kali. What we don't want, as mentioned in verse 5, is a government by the people who are not twice born. They have no proper training, culture or qualities as you would expect from twice born. And in verse, you know, 6, it describes how that a real ruler, you know, they must, you know, punish even by death people who kill animals, innocent animals. Yeah. Therefore, you know, the question is asked, you know, in one of our Purva Svadhyaya questions, you know, number 2, that what is the meaning of praja? It means one who has taken birth in the state. It includes both men and animals. So, in verse 9, Prabhupada sums it up that for want of pious executive heads and suitable laws, right, and he goes on further to say, if they protect the cows and the Brahminical culture, the Lord would be very pleased. So we need those, you know, pious executive heads, the suitable laws. What are the, and what are the two combined going to do? They're going to protect cows and Brahminical culture. How does such person, how do we create those laws and train those executive heads in order to protect cows and Brahminical culture? That's mentioned in verse 12 in the purport there, that we must look at the codes of the Srimad, the codes presented in the pages of Srimad Bhagavatam for the guidance of the blind persons who happen to be at the helm of all affairs. What's that?
It was not constipated.
Uh, Bhagavatam is the guy. Those executive heads,
okay.
You know, and their laws, right, the guidelines that they use is from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah. That was verse 12. Okay. So as Prabhupada points out in verse 13, you know, this is the difference between, you know, you must have rulers and laws, you know, rulers who are not afraid to implement these things. The difference is that, you know, the proper rulers, they have knowledge and the proper training to fearlessly challenge Kali. And that is, as Prabhupada says in verse 14, that cowardly and impotent executive heads of states. He says that dishonest miscreants flourish because of coward and impotent executive heads of state. But when the miscreants are punished in an exemplary manner, automatically all good fortune follows. So it's the same point. You know, the same point that basically when you have proper executive heads with suitable laws, they're guided by the Srimad Bhagavatam, protect cows and Brahminical culture, automatically the innocent citizens will flourish. It automatically benefits the offenseless. That's the statement in the actual translation. Which, you know, and in verse 14, that answers the Purva Svadhyaya question 3, that what is the prime duty of the state? The prime duty of the king or the executive head is to give protection in all respects to the peaceful, offenseless citizens of the state. Almost as part 2 of that question, you could say, therefore, the prime duty of the state is to arrange to convert everyone to become a devotee of the Lord. Thus, automatically, there will be peaceful, offenseless citizens. So you make everyone a devotee, and then you give them protection. Let's see. You know, following on from that in verse 16, Srila Prabhupada mentions that the state executive head is to see that Svadharma is not changed by the follower and should give all protection to the follower. So, you know, it's the same principle. The guidelines are given in Srimad Bhagavatam. What is the occupational duty of everyone? And the executive head, understanding those, must ensure that those occupational duties are followed, and if someone follows them, those people are protected. It's a similar point. All right, so we'll underline that. So the next sort of section, verses 20, so that's verses 3 to 16 of the 17th chapter. The next section where there's a lot of nice descriptions by Srila Prabhupada is in verses 24 to, what is it? 31. Okay, so straight off following on from our first topic today, that Prabhupada says that advocating the principles of Brahminical culture or the principles of austerity, cleanliness, mercy and truthfulness. So there you see just becoming explaining the broader concepts with more detail. We've said protect the cows in Brahminical culture. What does protecting Brahminical culture mean? Advocating these principles, austerity, cleanliness, truthfulness, non-violence, mercy. Okay.
That's general for this section.
Yes, yep. And so, how do we educate people in this? Brahminical culture?
Sample.
Yeah. What are our guidelines?
Laws.
What are the guidelines for the laws? What are the scriptures? Srimad Bhagavatam. That's it. We have to educate them in the Srimad Bhagavatam, the principles of Srimad Bhagavatam. Understanding that to understand Srimad Bhagavatam, people first have to study Bhagavad Gita as a preliminary study. But then they really have to understand the principles of Srimad Bhagavatam in order to understand the proper application, the need for the results of austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truthfulness, and especially how they should be applied to the used in the service, devotional service of the Supreme Lord. And not just for the sake of it. In verse 27, Prabhupada makes a really nice point that in Kali Yuga, now here we're saying that we want really good executive heads, so let's make a list of all the good executive heads we have in the world today. There's none. Okay. So Prabhupada makes a good point that if we train the people in the principles of Srimad Bhagavatam, that will counteract the effect that there are no real solid executive heads. Yes, yeah, in one sense. Yes, we should definitely try to train leaders, but Prabhupada mentions here in the purport that in the absence of a suitable king. So things still have to go on. And even if you have a suitable king, doesn't mean that the people are going to put him in power. Right? In the absence, Prabhupada could have been a suitable king. They wouldn't even make him the Lord Mayor of Melbourne or anything. In the absence of a suitable king to curb irreligious tendencies, educating the people systematically in the teaching of Srimad Bhagavatam will clear up the hazy atmosphere of corruption, bribery, blackmail, etc. Right? So then the people, if people are, you know, if we have a democracy, we don't have a system of training a king, and even if there are suitable kings, they're not being, generally not being put in power. But if the people are systematically educated in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it will come to the point where they will demand a suitable person, you know, be placed in there. And, you know, one of them who is suitably trained in the Srimad Bhagavatam and can implement them can be elected to that post. You know, it's a very good policy because, you know, in the age of Kali, things are topsy-turvy. That previously, you know, everything come from the top. You know, the monarchs, you know, set the pace of things and then it filtered down to society. In Kali Yuga, you know, that system is all but destroyed. And for one reason or another, you know, the people or the sudras more and more take power of world affairs. So if the mass of people are educated in the principles of Srimad Bhagavatam and they are determining the state of the world, then you know, it is a good system. Alright, so that is there. So we're teaching Srimad Bhagavatam to everyone, to the mass of people, and to the rulers. You know, it's an interesting situation in Kali Yuga. Generally, the you know, these very, very elevated principles of Srimad Bhagavatam, that level of knowledge, exalted knowledge, is usually passed to, you know, Raja Rishis and saintly persons, and it's sort of, you know, generally given at the top of society and some of it filters down. In Kali Yuga, you know, there's no one qualified at the top, and the mass of people themselves actually have full access to the most confidential knowledge by which they can literally take charge of putting the world into a better place. At the same time, as mentioned in verse 28, you know, those who are in positions of authority must be ready with sharp swords to kill persons creating corruptions from the angle of vision of the recognized shastras. It's pretty strong, isn't it? Then what's that?
The
yeah, put it up. We'll rub it out later. Yeah. 28. So, you know, to kill persons creating corruption from the angle of vision of the recognized shastras. So we're talking about the administrators. You know, the general devotees. Going around sharpening swords, running around killing people. Yeah. People who are authorised to make the laws and who are authorised to follow laws which are there to protect cows and Brahminical society, when that government is there, those persons are authorised according to Srimad Bhagavatam, to kill people who would go against that. You know, just like it said in the scriptures, that, you know, six type of aggressors can be killed. You know, one who tries to steal your wife, one who tries to set fire to your building. You know, those persons can be killed immediately. That doesn't necessarily mean that that particular person has authority to kill someone. You know, they basically, what it means is that they should then approach someone who's authorized by the government to punish persons who will then have that person killed. You know. They must at once close all shops of intoxication, drugs and wine, and force punishment even by death for those who indulge in habits of intoxication of all descriptions. That's still 28. Yep. Close all the shops of intoxication. Yep.
But we see intoxication even with the demigods. You are supposed to be at a higher level and serving Krishna.
Yeah.
And after all, demigods are posts where people are serving Krishna. So they are, in a way, devotees.
Yeah,
they're purified, but they are. But they also get intoxicated.
There are different levels of intoxication. And the intoxication of the demigods is not as degrading.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not as degrading.
Yeah. The intoxication of the demigods. Yeah, it's not. Yeah.
But also, Prabhu, when Sri Prabhupada was talking about prostitutes in chapter 11, he said there are wine shops in society, because if there are no wine shops, then people will illegally drink wine.
Mm.
That's why if there are no prostitutes available in the market, then men will induce others into prostitution.
Yeah. Look, Prabhupada mentions, you know, one of our questions is to question 4, chapter 17 of the Purva Svajaya question was explain the concept of apadama. Apadama is occupational duties at times of extraordinary happenings. Describes that Vishwamitra had to live on the flesh of dogs in extraordinary dangerous position. All right, so in other words, yep. Okay. In other words, when there are times of extraordinary happenings, that's apadama. Those who are well conversant with the laws of Srimad Bhagavatam will actually implement things in such a way that concessions are made in order to bridge the gap between the current extraordinary situation bringing us to the eventual goal we want. Therefore, we see that in many of Srila Prabhupada's discussions on eating cows, he said we have no objection to people eating meat, even cow flesh, just let them die naturally. He said we'll even, deliver you the meat, or you know, we have nothing against if one of our cows dies on a farm and someone wants to eat it, yes, take it, you know, you can have it, you have nothing against it, you haven't killed anything, you want to eat meat, we have nothing against that. just let them die naturally. So, you know, there are ways that you can actually create concessions within society, but what he's saying here in the purport to that verse, 17:16, chapter 17, verse 16, is that, but that does not mean that there should be regular slaughterhouses. There's a difference between allowing people who can't straight away give up their eating of meat, even cow killing, to just immediately come to that point, otherwise we'll, you know, the king will come through and lock all your heads off. Okay. Let us educate them in the Srimad Bhagavatam. While we're doing that, if they're so attached to eating meat, even the flesh of cows, let them eat the flesh of cows that have died already. Right? And there's millions of cows on the planet. You don't have to wait long, especially if you close, you know, slaughterhouses, before you're going to have a huge amount of cows that can be eaten. So, you know, you know, people have to be guided by the Srimad Bhagavatam. And therefore you see, as we've gone through, where Krishna tests Arjuna and his various devotees in the execution of their duty, where, you know, he's seeing whether they're just going to fanatically do something or whether they're going to apply, you know, very, very delicately, you know, various principles of religion so that everyone is satisfied, you know, is what we need to see. Apadhamma. Occupational duties, but there's some extraordinary circumstances or conditions. So that applies to all of them, you know, which is on the other side of the board there. Intoxication, gambling, meat eating, illicit sex. All of those can be, you know, made concessions for in such a way that the principles of Srimad Bhagavatam are implemented in society, and for those persons who can't immediately come to that point, there are some concessions made until, you know, gradually society coasts along. But for those who are actually, you know, on a different platform, that the state has said no slaughterhouses, you know, within Australia, and then it's found that someone's opened up a slaughterhouse, then the state may actually execute that person, to, you know, to set an example. And no one else will open up a slaughterhouse. I'll wait till the cow dies. Alright, you know, and another question which comes out of that, question 8 for verse, you know, for chapter 17, that describe what should be the state's attitude towards religion. And in verse 32 it describes that, you know, these principles of religion, austerity, cleanliness, mercy, truthfulness, they can be followed by the follower of any faith. They don't have to convert to be a Hindu or this or that. They can remain a Hindu, a Mohammedan, a Christian. The Bhagavatam, we follow the principles of the Bhagavatam, so our, you know, the devotee's attitude is that the Bhagavatam is just, you know, urging the followers to follow the principles of religion, that's all. Our attitude to religion is follow it, according to the Bhagavatam, and that means that whether you're situated as a Christian, Muslim, what have you, you can remain in that, but follow the principles of religion. Yeah. And, as mentioned in verse 31, that the friends of irreligiosity should be banished from the state. So, again, you know, Prabhupada has said that, you know, persons who, you know, go against the authority and, you know, try to open slaughterhouses, there's a death penalty. But, of course, as Prabhupada is saying here in verse 32 in the purport, 31, sorry, that, you know, they can be banished. So in other words, the state sets up that from now on, you know, in Australia, there'll be no slaughterhouses. Anyone who doesn't like this can leave the country. We'll give you 2 weeks to get out. If you, you know, if you're still here, that's okay. You can follow the Srimad Bhagavatam. But if you're caught, you know, trying to, you know, actually setting up a slaughterhouse, you will be executed like that. There's not, again, you know, there's not a fanatical thing. Someone's running around with a sword, lopping heads. First opportunity they get. It sounds like that, but at the same time, when it, you know, push comes to shove, and you get a bunch of, you know, hell's angels saying, oh, you know, we don't care about your, you know, your policies. Oh, cut their heads off, that's it. That's the end of your bikies and your thugs and what have you. You had the chance to leave, you had the chance to reform. You don't want any of that? Okay, be gone with you. That's it. And therefore in verse 35, well, Prabhupada says that the king, the executive head, must be so strong as to stand before the personality of Kali. As he rides up on his Harley Davidson. And he has to stand before him like the personality of death, Yamaraj. That is the way to rule the personalities of Kali, who create disturbance in the normal life of the state citizens. So, yeah. In verse 33, Prabhupada says, in this age of Kali, the greatest common formula of sacrifice is the Sankirtan Yajna. It can be performed anywhere and everywhere in order to drive away the personality of Kali. That the basic principle of religion is truthfulness, and the ultimate goal of all religion is to satisfy the Lord. So, you know, that quotation there in the purport to verse 33, it sums up you know, how all the principles of religion should be utilized to please the Lord. And that can be done by performing the Sankirtan Yajna. And that is the prime means of driving out the influence of Kali. So it brings us to our last little section on that, and a lot of that is taken from the purport of verse 38. Which, you know, further answers your question also, Svetha, about, you know, why the scriptures allow meat eating and intoxication. That is there in that purport as well. You know, the Vedic injunctions for the Prabhupadas is to gradually regulate their activities toward the path of liberation. Therefore, those who are in the lower stage of ignorance and who indulge in wine, women, flesh, drinking, therefore, Sultramani Jagya, association with women by marriage, flesh eating by sacrifices, are sometimes recommended. They're not necessarily considered a dharma if one, you know, follows what is recommended in the scriptures. But they're never really to be encouraged. So, although they're concessions, we're not trying to encourage irreligious activities. Concessions are made for people who, if it looks as though by giving those concessions it will help them to come from a lower stage to a higher stage. Concessions are never given where it actually encourages people to remain on that lower stage of irreligion and even degrade from there. If they're actually following their scripture. In many cases they're not. In many cases, you know, they're closer to just eating meat from, you know, slaughterhouses on a regular basis. They're closer to that, in fact, than actually following the scriptures. So in that verse it describes the recommendations in the scriptures are not meant for the encouragement of such a dharma, etc. It says, to make the best use of a bad bargain, the personality of Kali may be transferred to places of gambling, drinking, prostitution and slaughterhouses. Later it says, those who are addicted to these irreligious habits may be regulated by the injunctions of scripture. Right? So it's saying that you know, there may be some facility for persons who are addicted to these irreligious principles, but those facilities will be regulated by the injunctions of the scripture. But it's understood that in those places still Kali resides. So those people those people to some degree or another will be have some qualities, irreligious qualities of a lack of austerity, a lack of mercy, a lack of truthfulness, a lack of cleanliness. So they'll be influenced by that, even though they're following some concession by the state to keep the influence of Kali away from the innocent citizens and to help those attached people to have some concession and gradually make progress, you know, so everything is there. You know, what to speak of the age of Kali, even in we see that even Kshatriyas in Vedic times, you know, they're allowed to go into the forest and, you know, kill animals, wild animals, protect the sages, they can't just go in. They can't go in there and just unrestrictedly slaughter animals. But there's some concession; they can do some killing, and even sometimes they can eat some of that meat. But the Vedic formula is that those kings, after a lifetime of becoming a king, then at the age of about 50, they actually take vanaprastha and perform austerities and penances, which actually destroy the results of the sinful activities of killing animals, taking intoxication, some of the things that they've even done in a regulated way, according to scripture, as a kshatriya. And then gradually they take... dedicate themselves fully to the service of the Lord, you know, in order to. So we see that in the life of Muchukunda, that, you know, he understood and Krishna acknowledged that even though kshatriyas are performing activities which are recommended for kshatriyas, there is still a level of karma attached to those activities. There's not, so, you know, they're allowed to do it, but they. If they don't atone at some stage of that life, they will actually have to suffer some reaction, even though it's recommended in scriptures. We see that, you know, people who are, can sacrifice a goat or some animal like that before the goddess Kali, so they're chanting a mantra. So the concession is given, but the mantra means that as I am sacrificing you to be eaten, so... you know, then you will have the opportunity to eat me. So there's still a reaction, but it's allowed. So, you know, there's some reaction, but it's not as sinful as completely unauthorized killing, in which case they may have to go to one of the hellish planets and suffer there for a very, very long time and then suffer in, you know, hellish species of life. So there's some reaction, but it's vastly reduced, but they will have to suffer.
Do people know the meaning of that mantra?
Only if the Brahmins tell them. Okay. So we're looking at the final thing, verse 38. Ways to eradicate Kali, the influence of Kali. They can introduce the following principles. 2 compulsory fasting days in a month. Very good for austerity. Very good for economics. Yeah. Compulsory marriage of young boys and girls attaining the age of 24 and 16 years of age, respectively. Abolishing the Divorce Act. That encourages prostitution. Giving 50% in charity, the citizens, up to 50% of their income, for the purpose of creating a spiritual atmosphere in the state or human society. Right? 50%, up to 50%. And they should individually and collectively, they should use it for preaching the principles of the Bhagavatam, Karma Yoga, doing everything for the satisfaction of the Lord, regularly hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam from authorized persons, chanting the glories of the Lord in temples or at home, rendering service to the preachers of the Bhagavatam, residing in holy dharms, okay, so this is a very interesting point because Kali was given the concession that he could live in a place where there is gold. Now, one of the things that Prabhupada mentions, of course, is that the gold standard currency, in other words, where you get a piece of paper which represents some actual gold that you don't actually ever see or touch, is based upon a falsehood. Because that piece of paper is not on par with the actual gold. So, you know, the state can say, yeah, we have $1 billion. Yeah, the cash is all out there amongst all the citizens, but within their reserves they get this little couple of little bits of gold, which doesn't add up. So Prabhupada says actual gold coins should be used for exchange, and this will stop the prostitution of gold. What's that? What's that?
The contestant
that's maximum 24. I think it's
21.
In this purport, it says boys 24 and girls 16.
Boys 24, isn't it?
And girls 16.
Yeah.
The 21? Is there a 21?
I was thinking that that's the maximum. They should not be unmarried after. So I was thinking they were married a couple of years before that last moment. Because it's also said that girls shouldn't be married after 21. I think that's why I was thinking.
Now we see in verse 39 that the king gave Kali permission to live where there is gold, because wherever there is gold there is falsity, intoxication, lust, envy and enmity, basically all the four principles of irreligion. Yeah, so therefore, that's why in the previous verse, verse 38, the Prabhupada is saying that we should give 50% of our income should be utilised in the propagating the Sankirtana movement. If we do that, Kali has no influence over such gold. Only when gold or finances or wealth or any sort of opulence is not dedicated, you know, when it's not dedicated with the Sankirtana movement, then Kali resides in that place of wealth, extreme opulence, and all the four principles of irreligion will flourish in that place. And therefore we see that most people, it doesn't matter whether they're a prime minister, you know, famous person in which the whole world is watching, whoever they may be, if they're extremely wealthy, they take drugs, they're involved in prostitution, you know, gambling and meat eating. They have this wealth and it just allows Kali to flourish. But if we have wealth, best the wealth should be in forms of like gold and, you know, jewellery and, you know, things that actually have a proper value. And even that wealth, so that at least reduces the amount of corruption that can flourish, but still Kali resides there, and therefore that wealth should also be used at least up to 50% in the Sankirtana movement of the Lord, and that person then, even having wealth or gold, will not be influenced by the age of Kali.
But we find that more at least in my limited knowledge, that a lot of grahasthas, including our own family, we don't give 50% of our wealth to the temple.
It works out in different ways, so again we have to be a little practical. There are many devotees who perhaps could earn 50 or even more percent more earnings than what they're doing, who because of the amount of devotional service they're doing don't earn that, so that's another way of giving 50%. There are many devotees who actually could earn thousands and thousands of dollars, but don't. They can't because of the amount of time that they actually spend at the temple doing different services. So in effect, some of them are giving more than 50% just like that, even though it's not necessarily handing out the cash. So, you know, we have to apply that, it can be applied in many different ways, you know, practically. But still, you know, each devotee should, you know, assess himself that, you know, if a devotee feels that, if they look realistically and they feel that, you know, I have massive opulence and I just use so little of my time and my wealth in the service of the Lord, well then that's not good. They shouldn't try and increase, you know. Otherwise, what happens, of course, is that Kali thrives, and Kali then, by the influence of Kali, that wealth and opulence is used in ways that lead to the degradation of that person. Even, you know, a devotee, you know, can become corrupted by it because it allows a foothold for Kali to influence that person, and they have to be very careful. Then, becoming influenced by Kali, there are certain reactions, and those reactions gradually whittle away one's wealth. They can be, you know, legal, you know. Legal, you know, litigations. You can suck up thousands and thousands of dollars. You know, accidents, health. You know, friends. You know, associating with bad people who somehow manage to squander our money on our behalf. And Kali will get in there and create certain reactions, which gradually, you know, mean that that person. The wealth that they should have given, you know, will be taken by Kali anyway. I always remember this. You know, one devotee. I had a gold ring with a nice red coral. You know, it was a really, really nice ring. I made it up when I went through a Mars period, and I finished my Mars period. I really like this ring, but a devotee came up to me and said, "Oh, I really like that. You know, I'm going through a Mars period. Can I have that gold ring?" And I thought, "Oh, you know, gee, you know, I'm so attached. I really like, you know." So I didn't give it to him, and within a few months, it was stolen. And I always look back and I think I should have just given it to him, you know, because Kali took it off me anyway. You know, I then had a ring which I didn't really need. You know, and you know, I should have just given it to him. But you know, it's an example. Exactly. So he missed out, I missed out, and really I should have just given it to him. So, you know, I actually, quite often I'll do that now. Sometimes a devotee would come up and say, "I like your jump." I said, "Do you want it?" No. So, you like your socks? You know, it's okay. Okay. All right, that pretty much brings...
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, there, taking that example of it, that car was helping a devotional service.
Yes.
That is there, so that's just a difference. But still, sometimes, by giving, sometimes it will be harm.
Well, I eventually,
It also happens with people whom you're a little close to.
Yeah.
That time we may be a little more emotional and want to give a little more, but that. We may be spoiling the other person.
Yeah. I did make him promise, though, in that case, that he would, reimbursed me for the car, and ultimately he did, although the car was, you know, I got it fixed, it was never quite the same, but in essence there, he had accumulated wealth which he should have given to a brahmana, you know. In that case, you know, after he had been on Sankirtan, he was, you know, well and truly in a position to reimburse me. But he actually hung on to a position of opulence, and therefore he suffered by, at the hands of Kali. Ultimately, I actually, you know, he did ultimately reimburse me, although, as I say, the car was basically a write-off. It never really worked after that, and I think within a short time I had to get rid of it. I have never... I know that I'm extremely lucky when it comes to money. Like, you know, I mean, I have to... you always have to, you know, spend money on fixing or what have you, but I have noticed that Krishna always, you know, makes sure that I've got a, you know, semi-reliable car. I've never sort of been, you know, the loser in that respect. You know, I mean, far beyond, you know, my destiny. You know, knowing my astrological indications and what have you, I shouldn't be as lucky with vehicles as what I am. And I put that down to the fact that, you know, I was quite willing to give that car to the Sankirtan movement ultimately. But, you know, you are correct that we have to be... if we give something to the Sankirtan movement, whether it be a car, money, time, a child, we want to know that what we're offering to the Sankirtan movement is going to be used for the Sankirtan movement, and that we're giving it to the person who will get the maximum benefit for the Sankirtan movement from what we've given. You know? If someone works very, very hard for their money and they come to the temple and give $500, they want to search out those devotees who are responsible and capable of utilizing that $500 in the Sankirtan movement to the absolute best, without it being squandered foolishly or, you know, lost through corruption. So, you know, that should be there. So when it says give 50% of, you know, up to 50% according to our capacity to the Sankirtan movement, that's not just saying, you know, hand over money, this, that or the other, and it's not even properly going to the Sankirtan movement. You know, we need to be careful and intelligent about it. I mean, you know, there have been some very scary stories in ISKCON. I won't tell you, I don't want to scare the hell out of you. You know, different devotees who in a position of authority, you know, and squandering, you know, literally under the influence of Kali, the hard-earned money of congregational members. Very, very disturbing. Very disturbing. So,
does that affect our history of time that we've been given money?
Well, what happens is that, you know, Krishna in his kindness will award the person who's giving, you know, intended for Krishna. Krishna, you know, will accept that sentiment and accept, you know, fully that whatever you've worked for and given, you get the benefit. But the person who's actually under the influence of Kali, you know, where opulence and gold resides, and is, as I said, even as a devotee, not utilizing that in the service. Of course, if money is given for the Sankirtan movement, then every penny of that must be used, not 50% of it. You know, everything that's actually given, earmarked, this is for the Sankirtan movement, every single penny of that must be for the Sankirtan movement. which does include maintaining devotees. Where there are devotees who are fully dependent upon a temple, and we're maintaining those devotees, then that's also giving to the Sankirtan movement. But those devotees who are being maintained by a temple or by a congregation would be expected to live very, very simple lives. You know, if you sort of got a devotee, you're maintaining them, you know. You're maintaining that devotee as a gift to the Sankirtan movement. That devotee is driving around in the best of cars and wearing all fancy clothes and living the high life, you know, like that. Then we'd probably stop maintaining that person anyway. So we have to be a little careful. So here, Prabhupada is giving the guidelines, the principles. All right, we're getting them in a nutshell, in essence. And if we study the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, even by the time you become bhakti vaibhavis, you should know how to apply all of these things properly, you know, intelligently. Because there's so much information that we would have covered. Okay, 38 to 45. There are a couple of principles here. So we see that in verse 39, in essence, King Parikit has organized society in such a way that Kali can reside in some places and the innocent citizens are protected from that influence. And there are some concessions for those who are very attached to those so that they can gradually advance, right? We've got down there something about gold.
Yep.
And in verse 44, you know, it just summarizes again, especially in the purport there, that the society must be organized to accept the principles of religion, austerity, cleanliness, mercy, truthfulness. And to make that favourable for those principles, you've got to shut down all places of gambling, drinking, prostitution, falsity, intoxication like that. And in verse 45, Prabhupada does mention that without state support, no doctrines of philosophy or religious principles can progressively advance. there should be complete cooperation between the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas for the common good. Yes.
Are they doing a mistake or they're trying to, what are they trying to do? Someone says Balaji wine, so they get some very
mistake.
So really mysterious, using all these names.
Yeah, look, all of those places should be shut down. Heads should roll. Verse 45? There should be state support in order for philosophy of religion to progressively advance. State support means cooperation between the Brahmanas and the Kshatriyas for the common good.
What is the exact meaning of Brahmanical culture?
Austerity, cleanliness, mercy, and truth.
So those qualities, they are there, that's
yes.
The
Brahmanical culture means cultivating those qualities within society. And the Brahmanas should be the best example of that. Now, in chapter 18, we see that Sukadeva Goswami describes Maharaj Parikshit's attitude in response to being cursed, his dealing with the personality of Kali. And the sages of Naimisharanya, as we heard, were performing the 1,000-year sacrifice and described how their bodies had become blackened because of the smoke from their yajna. And they wanted to hear from Sukadeva Goswami about Krishna. So, of course, then there's the story of exactly how Maharaj Parikshit was out hunting. He became fatigued. He entered the hermitage of Samika Rishi, who was sitting silently in meditation. Not being received, Parikshit Maharaj became angry. And he rewarded the sage with a garland in the form of a dead snake. Sringi, hearing about his father, cursed Maharaj Parikshit to be bitten within 7 days by a snake bird. And the father, Samika Rishi, lamented. And he prayed to the Lord for forgiveness for his son's foolishness. Okay, now, There are several questions related to that, which relate to the Purva Swadhyaya questions. But what I'm going to stick to, I'll ask you soon if you have any questions unanswered on those Purva Swadhyaya questions or what have you. But I'm just going to continue with our discussion on how the guidelines to defeat Kali, and this time we're looking at verses in chapter 18, 32-37, how the age of Kali was able to enter, and this time it's in relationship with this story of King Parikshit being cursed. We see in verse 35, of course, that the personality of Kali in the purport was seeking the opportunity to establish authority, and by the grace of the Lord he found a hole in the puffed up, inexperienced son of a Brahmana. In the purport to verse 32, Prabhupada says the inexperienced boy gave a chance for the age of Kali to enter into the field of Vedic culture. Hatred of the lower orders of life began from this Brahmana boy.
Won't you say that before that itself, when Kali said that Kali can stay in gold, and Kali takes the opportunity to stay in the world of the king, making him put the snake on the Brahmana. That itself there was a sign of Kali entering in.
No, Maharaj Parikshit wasn't necessarily influenced by the age of Kali. Not at all.
Then why did he do that?
It's a good question. So let's come back to that in a minute. All right. Is that not one of our Purva Swadhyaya questions? Which one is that? Okay, we'll come back to that. So we've looked at verse 35, Prabhupada mentioned. Yep, okay.
Explain how the age of Kali was able to enter.
That's the one. The reasons why Parikshit Maharaj became petite. And with relationship to which chapter? 18, yeah, so this one, yeah, that's 25, yeah, okay, we'll come back to them. So we looked at purport to verse 35, Kali seeking the opportunity, found a hole in the puffed up, inexperienced son of a Brahmana. And that gave, as mentioned in verse 32, you know, this inexperienced boy gave the chance for the age of Kali to enter within the field of Vedic culture. You know, hatred of the lower orders of life began from this Brahmana boy. In verse 33, it's interesting, Prabhupada describes this Sringi, a qualified son of a great Brahmana, attained the required brahminical power both by birthright and by training, but he was lacking in culture. By the influence of Kali, the son of a Brahmana became puffed up with a brahminical power. Prabhupada says, downfall of the brahminical powers began as they gave importance to birthright without culture. Very important in our society as well. And Prabhupada, you know, always stressed this, of course. It's very important that because he's given the opportunity for us to take Brahman or Brahmani initiation, we must develop the Lakshana? Yeah, the Lakshana. The qualities or the characteristics of the Brahmana and then practice that. So that's the culture. Culture means the training is there. What are the characteristics? Develop those characteristics and then work according to those characteristics and knowledge. That's the culture. If one, we do see, even within our society, what to speak of other societies who actually tend to be more influenced by Kali, for various reasons which are all mentioned here, you know, simply by birthright, without training, you know, people feel that they're, you know, Kali just, you know, loves that field, you know, for exploitation, a Brahmana who is by birthright a Brahmana but has no training, what to speak of culture. And even if someone is, even within our movement, we get Brahmanas who are, you know, trained, but then give up the practice of acting like a Brahmana, there's also a field for Kali to enter. One must have the knowledge, the training, and then work as a Brahmana. Or, you know, Kshatriya, Vaishya, whatever, like that. So this explains how Kali was able to enter. Especially, you know, the Brahmana boy had so much power. In the purport to verse 34, he says, he justified the wrong act in a way characteristic of the Brahmanas of Kali Yuga. You know, so he was just showing his impudency amongst his playmates. You know, killing a king like Maharaj Parikit just to make a show of acquired brahminical power, the inexperienced son of a Brahmin had committed a great mistake. That's from purport to verse 36, and in verse 37, Prabhupada mentions the personality of Kali conquered the Brahmana boy first and gradually the other castes. So these are different statements as to how the age of Kali was able to enter, step by step, gradually increasing. You know, the end of the battle of Kurukshetra, then Krishna disappears, then Yudhisthira and the others disappear. You know, then through the Brahmana boy, you know, an inexperienced son of a Brahmana. Plus, we can understand, as mentioned, you know, the answer to question 11. Why did the Lord arrange for a young boy to commit such an offence? And as Prabhupada points out, that you know, so that he could be easily excused. So his father prayed on his behalf. He's just a young boy. He doesn't know what he's doing. You know, so naturally the Lord will excuse the actions of a young boy like this. So ultimately no one really got the blame for Kali, which was the Lord's. The Lord desired Kali to enter at this particular time for different reasons, and the Lord didn't really want to lump blame on any particular person. He arranged for a Brahmana boy to do that. It allowed Kali to enter, and at the same time it allowed the no one to, you know, be completely blamed for everything that happened to Kali Yuga. Alright. Now we've discussed, especially from chapter 17, different ways in which Prabhupada gives influence, ways, guidelines by which one can become free from the influence of Kali. Question 2 in chapter 18 is very similar. What is the technique for driving away Kali? And in the purport, Prabhupada mentions constant chanting of the holy names and qualities of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. There is no chance at all for Kali to enter. Okay. Let's look at the reasons why Maharaj Parikit became fatigued from Now, what have you got listed? 25, 29, and 31 of chapter 18? Only 25. Alright. Note down all of these verses if you really want a complete answer. 25, 28, 29, and 31. That'll give you a nice overview properly. Of chapter 18. Will give you actually a good, because we see, you know, so if you answer this question from 25, that's sufficient, but if you want a little further explanation, then we'll go over. One, there's no real reason for him to become extremely fatigued and hungry and thirsty, as mentioned in verse 25, because, you know, he was a great devotee of the Lord, and they never really become perturbed by the bodily demands. So therefore, immediately we understand it's by the desire of the Lord. Why did the Lord desire that? Because he's creating this situation which is favourable for the renunciation of Maharaj Parikshit from worldly activities. Continuing in verse 25, you know, the Lord creates an awkward situation. The devotee becomes obliged to renounce. Yeah. So he's certainly creating a favourable situation for Maharaj Parikshit to totally become completely renounced from worldly activities, and at the same time he's providing the setting by which Srimad Bhagavatam would be spoken. So therefore the Lord in essence is creating a situation that happens to Maharaj Parikshit, that he becomes tired and fatigued and hungry and thirsty, which is very unusual, you know, for such a caliber of devotee. So that Srimad Bhagavatam will be spoken to him in the same way that Krishna put Arjuna into a sense of illusion so that Bhagavad Gita could be spoken. So in essence, Prabhupada mentions in verse 31 that, you know, being distressed by hunger and thirst was only a show. Now, he says this, he says the king, he endured, even in the womb of his mother, he endured so much. Even as a little embryo, he's a little fighter, a little tacker. You know, a Brahmastra. What else happened there? The situation in this case was therefore all planned by the Lord.
So from the same argument that they said that even the Brahmana, like King Krishna gives remembrance, forgets everything. So the Brahmana boy has been given a situation where he has to forget, so that Krishna's plan was executed.
Yes, that's right.
The Brahma boy also was not the same.
No, not the same. No, he was uncultured, whereas Parikshit Maharaj was actually practicing the culture of his training. So we can't compare the two. Now, we see in verse 29 that it does explain that same point again, that just, you know, about Arjuna being bewildered to speak the Bhagavad Gita, Parikshit being bewildered to speak the Srimad Bhagavatam. That is mentioned in verse 31, sorry. And verse 29 describes that, you know, the only justification for Maharaj Parikshit's behavior is that it was ordained by the Lord. So Prabhupada says very clearly there in the purport that is the only justification, no other reason. He's calling the king back to Godhead, as mentioned in verse 31. So we see there's different descriptions. There is one place there that it does mention, can't see it offhand, but that, you know, even a qualified person like Parikshit Maharaj, who's obviously very attached to the Lord and very renounced, still, you know, the nature of just giving up everything in this material world, you know, we see that you know, even very elevated devotees like Parikshit Maharaj, to just stop everything and just go back to Godhead. You just walk away from your kingdom, your family, you know, every single thing that you're doing, even though you're, in one sense you're acting on behalf of the Lord, it's a very difficult thing, and therefore the Lord makes it just a little bit easier. You know, he creates a situation that's, you know, okay, we'll just make it a little bit more easier, that, you know, now you've got no choice. Like that. Look at Prabhupada, you know. Krishna did the very similar. Prabhupada, you know, we Nitya Siddha, but we understand that the Lord still acted in such a way that he had no choice. You know, he was still thinking, he still surrendered to Krishna, still thinking, I'm surrendered to Krishna, but I'm doing it this way. And Krishna says, no, you surrendered to me, but I want you to do it this way. And I'm not giving you any other choices from now on. Okay. All right, that's pretty much it. Now, before you go, you got an appointment? What's that? You've got an appointment? Okay. All right, okay. So you're ready for the exam next week? Who's ready? Huh? What's that? Yeah, we do, actually. Although, you know, chapter 19, there are, we'll do chapter 19, that Maharaj Parikshit did not want to beg his pardon. That's for Sringi. He fasted and sat down on the bank of the Ganges. Many rishis arrived. And Sukadeva Goswami arrived. And then the king asked him about various questions about what one is supposed to do before one dies. Now, it's a bit of a storyline, which, you know, no doubt you have all read that. And there's a few questions there, Purva Svadhyaya questions. But most of your, most of the discussion, as far as, especially your open book questions, we have all discussed. So there's no, there's no open book questions or, you know, major discussion there. Now, I'm quite happy to stay for an extra 10 minutes with anyone who wants to discuss any of those Purva Svadhyaya questions, and then that will be on tape, and even, you know, those who do have to go can, during the week, listen to that. I'd like to do an exam next week. Because next week, next week is the 10th. It won't be too difficult. The more difficult thing, in fact, is actually the questions, the open book questions, which we have discussed. Even in, you know, the notes to unit 5, lesson 5, the Mayapur Institute, they put very little into that, you know, because it's very matter of fact. You read it through, there are a few Purva Svadhyaya questions to answer, it doesn't form, you know, a huge body of discussion or what have you that is, you know, required. But I'm quite happy to just, you know, in 5 or 10 minutes just answer any questions that you may have with regard to any of the chapters. So, you know, what we'll do is we'll read out the questions, and you'll probably find that. So, first we'll look at 19. Basically from 14 to 19, right? But there won't be a lot of questions, if any, from chapter 19. So I would suggest you read it, but most likely I would say study the chapters, particularly that we've, you know, covered more progressively from 14 to 18. I want you to read chapter 19 and answer those questions. I won't put any in the exam, right? But they're quite elementary, and it doesn't take a huge amount of discussion. But we can catch up on it a little later. But you know, the difficulty is we've got Gorpanim coming up. If we don't have an exam, it's going to be like another fortnight or 3 weeks before we even have a class. You know, which means that it just, you know, time just goes on. So we won't have questions from chapter 19, but we have covered all the others. If there are any questions that you have from those others that you want me to quickly look at now, I'm quite happy to do that. Yep? Or for the open book questions? The third one? The third one is okay. 3-4 explain how the age of Kali was able to enter with reference to verses 32 and 37 from chapter 15 and 32 and 37 from chapter 18, right? 3 marks and 7 marks for summarizing Prabhupada's guidelines how to defeat Kali with reference to chapter 17. So 10 marks, yeah, for that whole question. 3. So just, everyone just scan through the questions, and if there's anything that you, offhand, that, I will say that, one, because of the big break that we had between last year and this year, people going to India, people, you know, going all over the world. And then a couple of weeks here that we've had a bit of a break, it won't be a very difficult closed book test. 10 questions. there'll be a couple of analogies, which usually carry about 3 marks each. And you know, there'll be, so it's not going to be particularly difficult because of, you know, a lot of the interruptions, so I can understand that. But I would expect you to do well, you know, with your the open book test, right? So, you know, we have covered it. It's there in the on the net, and which means that next week we'd have the exam, which is, what date is that? The 5th. When's Gorpanim?
20th of March.
So then we have one week where we come back, and we'd actually start Canto 2, but, one, we would have, we'll look at the exam results. I'll hand back anything else that hasn't been marked. We'll actually come back between now and the following week. The other thing is, see, next week we have we could actually have the exam between 3:30 and 5 o'clock, and we could actually spend an hour and a half before the exam, if you think there are anything, just a bit of a revision. If you think that there are some things after a week of study that you're not quite clear on, and you just want to, have a bit of a refresh. Yeah. Is anyone interested? Yeah. Okay. So we just have our normal class time from 2 to 5. We'll spend about an hour and a half, and we'll just go over anything that you may not be clear about, especially, towards the whole thing. And then we'll have the exam. So we've got about an hour and a half. You can hand your essays in the following week. All right, so that basically gives you a full week, really, to go over all the Purva Svadhyaya questions and anything you're not clear on to discuss with me an hour and a half before the exam. Then we'll do the exam, and then you've got a whole week to concentrate on the open book essays, and you hand those in, and then we'll begin Canto 2.
So the exam is at 3:30.
Exam at 3:30. So you can either come at 3:30,
or
if you want to ask some questions, get in on the discussion, then come at 2:00. They will be from 14 to 18. Open book. Yeah. Okay. Open book. Question 1A. It's 5, 2, and 3. All right, which is 5 for a devotee's attitude towards suffering, 2 for the reference to the response of Dharma, and 3 for how to personally apply those principles. 1B is to draw general principles, right, from the example of Maharaj Parikit in response to being cursed. There's 6 points to that, drawing the general principles, and 4, explain the personal relevance of those principles. Now, the second question, part A, is there's 6 points for drawing lessons applicable for preaching for Maharaj Yudhisthira's retirement, and there's 4 to explain how they're applicable for preaching. So one is to, the first part is what are the lessons, and 2, how do we apply them for preaching, right? Question 2A, describe the connection between Brahminical culture and cow protection. 6 for that. Discussing its relevance for ISKCON is 4. And I think I explained 3, so everyone has that, which is, I'll say it again, that for explaining how the age of Kali was able to enter, 3, according to those 2 references in chapter 15 and 18, and 7 points for summarising Prabhupada's guidelines to defeat Kali, and that's with reference to chapter 17.
Question 1B, what was the question?
1B, 6 and 4. 6, mm-hmm, for drawing the general principles from Maharaj Parikit's attitude,
yeah,
and 4 for explaining the personal relevance of those principles. It is personal application question.
For the last third question, the summarizing Prabhupada's guidelines.
Yes.
We discussed so much so.
In chapter. Oh, you listen to the lecture?
No, we discussed so much of. What I mean to say is we have to put it in within 200.
Summarize it, yes. Yes. So just a summary. It's on the board here, too.
Everything you have
Yeah, no, well, yeah. Yes. No, you should be able to do that. Let's make sure. So, four questions. So you're writing about 250 words for each of the four questions.
250 words.
Yeah. How many? No, we got. Basically, yeah. With each module, we want to do 900 to 1,000 words. So if there's three questions, divide it by three. If there's four questions, divide it by four. So that way you can do about 350 like that. Yeah. 330. 20. 20.
Thank you.
Yeah.